Welcome to Management Matters, a National Academy of Public Administration podcast, where policy meets practice. I'm Terry Girton, president of the Academy. On this episode, I'll discuss what it takes to build fiscally healthy communities in these challenging times with my guest, Scott Pattison. Scott is a fellow of the Academy, and he's currently the Deputy Executive Director of the Multi-State Tax Commission. Scott, thanks so much for joining me today.
I'm delighted to join you.
Well, we love having these conversations, and certainly the things that you're focused on right now are really top of mind. I mean, you were the director of the National Association of State Budget Officers for 14 years. Then you led the National Governors Association. You also chaired the Association for Budgeting and Financial Management, and now the Deputy Executive Director of the Multi-State Tax Commission. So this perspective has allowed you to view the fiscal situation in the country from a lot of different perches over several years. Did you ever see anything like this, like a global pandemic plus a $3 trillion federal deficit?
I have to say, I think this time period gives us a great example of how hard it is to predict the future, not only the fiscal future, but any future. I never expected anything this significant. To me, this is really unbelievable. It's the perfect storm of so many factors, as you know, which is really going to hit particularly state and local governments, but also the federal government for many years to come in terms of how they manage their finances. I was one of those, like a lot of us, concerned about the federal debt before all this, and now it's just going to be an exceptionally difficult time period for the next few years to deal with this really fiscal storm.
So talk for a minute about the difference between the deficit and the debt, right? We talk about those sometimes interchangeably, but it makes a difference as to how,
well, it does, you know,
how you
because,
think about resolution.
Yeah, no, it really does, because the deficit tends to be the annual amount that you're borrowing. But the debt, which is unbelievably huge, of course, particularly at the federal level, means the debt that's been accumulated and we're still paying the interest on that. And one of the things that I think is particularly concerning about the nation's fiscal health is the more you borrow, the more interest payments you have and the more debt you have to pay on, and a higher percentage of the money that comes in has to go toward servicing that debt. Now, we are lucky at the moment because interest rates are very low, so it's pretty cheap to borrow. But over time, that's going to be a pretty serious problem. And again, whether it's your household debt, and it's hard to compare governments and households, but the principle is the same. The more you borrow, the more you're going to have to pay later. And that's money you're simply paying to service the debt, to pay the interest, and not for other things like services that you might want to spend money on.
So debt and deficit are sort of two symptoms of the nation's fiscal health.
Exactly. Yeah.
When the Academy announced its grand challenges in public administration last November, we identified 12, and one of those is advance the nation's long-term fiscal health. So, you know, when we are talking about the pandemic today, we're talking about public health. But how would you assess the nation's fiscal health?
Well, I think it's terrific you're talking about that, because we tend to overlook. I notice when I read the newspaper or see things in the media, there's so much talk about things like healthcare and COVID, as there should be. But we tend to overlook the importance of looking at the fiscal health of the nation, particularly the nation's governments at the federal, state, and local level. So it's really good to be doing that. I would say that our long-term fiscal health, unfortunately, is in huge, huge peril. And I think we need to be thinking about that right now. I would have actually said this before this pandemic, but we're adding so much, not only to the deficit and the nation's debt, but what we're doing is we're postponing the reckoning that we're going to have, because we have so many liabilities we have to pay for. People expect, whether it's 10 years or 20 years from now, they expect their Social Security, their Medicare. People expect their pensions at the state and local level, and we're not putting any money into that when we're in a crisis like this. So to me, that's part of the problem, that we are not only adding to our debts at the moment, we're also postponing the reckoning of dealing with additional liabilities because we're not putting any money toward that. Now, I will say, I think it's important to be realistic. We are in a crisis, and the short-term stimulus that we are doing both through things like the CARES Act, the Federal Reserve actions, those are important. But we have to also remember, if we're going to do that now, once the crisis is over, as the economy gets better, we have to deal with this fiscal health. We can't ignore it. We have to be more disciplined in all ways. And I'm doubtful from a political standpoint that elected officials are going to have the incentive to do that and protect the nation's future fiscal health long term.
Well, you've been in these spaces for a number of years. There's a lot of conversation now about the comparing the economic impact of the current pandemic with the economic impact of the Great Recession in 2007 to 2009. From your perspective, what's similar and what's different about how the nation was positioned coming into the crisis? I mean, neither one of them were, you know, unless you had perfect foresight and a really accurate magic eight ball, nobody kind of saw them coming. But how is the nation positioned coming into it, and what do you think will be similar or different coming out?
Well, there's no question right now. The Great Recession was a pretty difficult fiscal time, both for the economy, but also for the nation's fiscal health. But it is different this time because the amount of stimulus and the already very high deficits and debt at the federal level made going into this crisis a situation where, particularly at the federal level, we were in a lot worse shape. So as a result, it's going to be very difficult to get ourselves out of it. I think there is good news, and this is, of course, speculation. It's hard to know what the future will bring, but I think there is good news that this is a little bit different than a financial type recession. And so it is very possible, if you get effective treatment, even a vaccine, the economy could come back very quickly, in which case, if that occurs, hopefully early 2021, then you could start to see the nation's finances improve because you kind of stop the bleeding in terms of the financial picture. And so I think there is a difference in that we're in a worse financial situation during this crisis because of having to do so much more stimulus. I think it's really interesting. I remember so much debate about the Recovery Act in 2009. That was less than a trillion. It ended up, I think, being about $831 billion. We're already closer to $3 trillion this time. So we really do need, we do have a lot of hope that the economic situation will be different and will recover quicker, because it did take a long time for the housing crisis and those types of financial difficulties to recover. And again, this is a health crisis, and a lot of economists do believe, and I agree with them, that we may recover quicker. But again, we've dug a bigger hole. So even if we start to recover quicker, we better start focusing on the fiscal problems we've created as a result.
Yeah, and you might say we had some pre-existing conditions coming into this, just to keep that health analogy.
That is a great way to put it, Terry.
Stretched out
That's
a little
so
bit.
So true, yeah. Well, and I have to make a comment about that. I think it's really important to praise the states and local governments versus the federal government. Unlike the federal government, which entered this in some pretty high debt situations, the state and local governments actually, during the good times, as we recovered from the Great Recession, actually, for the most part, they built up their rainy day funds and they tried to pay off some liabilities like pension debt. So I have to give a little shout out to the fiscal responsibility on the state and local level.
Well, so thinking about that, though, what kind of challenges do they face today? I mean, they're really on the front lines of falling tax revenues, falling fee and service revenues. And at the same time, they're also in the front lines of increased service delivery, right? So in a state who's probably into their budget year already, never having anticipated that they were going to experience this much disruption, how do they respond in the near term? And what did they think about for the longer term?
Well, it is exceptionally difficult for states. And frankly, it's even more difficult for the local governments, because at the federal level, it's a national government. They have control over interest rates, the currency, and they have a lot more flexibility financially and certainly a lot more ability to borrow money. You don't have that at the state level and even less so at the local level. So it really is, and I think this is overlooked a lot of times, especially at the federal level. The state, you really have at the state and local level a zero-sum game. They have to balance. There are nuances to that, and people can quibble. But for the most part, they only can spend what comes in. And so if you're in that type of situation, it's exceptionally difficult because, as you know, the revenue's crashing. You have estimates for this current fiscal year of at least a $200 billion shortfall for states whose overall total spending isn't that much more than a trillion. And you have 34 states that entered this fiscal year on July 1st with 20% declines in their revenue. That's unheard of. I've never heard of that in my career, of a 20% or more decline in that many states. So it's a really, really difficult situation. They're doing what they can. But as you've pointed out, when you have a health crisis, you spend more. And so they have less money coming in, and they have to spend more on things like healthcare. And they're tapping their rainy day funds. They're cutting where they can. The federal government stimulus money, to some extent, has helped. It's nowhere near sufficient to cover all the cuts. And so I think where they are right now in this very difficult situation at the state and local level is, without additional federal help, they're just going to have to keep cutting. You can't really, both politically and economically, do tax increases during this crisis. So they're not really going to be able to figure out a way to get more money in. So they're going to have to cut what they're spending. And so every federal dollar that comes in actually prevents an additional cut. I know there's controversy politically about that. But otherwise, you're going to see, especially starting, I would say, in the mid-fall period around October, you're going to see furloughs, layoffs, cuts to all parts of state and local government, because they simply have no choice. It's not that they want to do that, but you can only spend so much. Some states will borrow, but that's very unusual. I know states like Illinois and New Jersey are looking at borrowing, but most states either don't have the mechanisms to do much borrowing or the ability to do so. So you're not going to see a lot of debt at the state level.
This seems like it starts to snowball, right? So even if the majority of the revenue comes from a property tax base, and property tax assessments aren't changing, the national employment situation is such that people may not be able to pay those taxes. So those start to get deferred. As you start to lay off state and local government employees, that further impacts the labor market, which further impacts, right, all of the revenue bases, sales tax and property taxes. So how do you get out of that snowball?
That's such a great point. Yeah, I keep telling people you ain't seen nothing yet, because the states were able, through rainy day funds, and they're still tapping those, and other actions to kind of, you're able to stave off some of the most pain. You can stave off pain for a while, but at some point you can't. And I think that's where we're getting to, as you pointed out. I think a great example is October 1st, a large number of airline employees are likely going to be laid off unless there is pretty significant federal action. Hard to predict whether that will occur. So as a result, as you said, suddenly all these people are on unemployment. They're not going to spend as much, so you don't get sales tax. They're not providing income tax revenue. And again, it just snowballs. You have less revenue coming in, but you have to spend more on these people. And so it really is a really difficult challenge. And I think we will see the worst of the fiscal situation, particularly for state and local governments, through the autumn into the holiday period as we hit December and the end of the year.
Oh, so it goes along with our conversation sort of before we started recording, which is, oh, great, and asteroids.
Right, exactly.
So we're thinking about worse economic news coming into the fall. You know, one of our objectives in identifying this long-term fiscal health grand challenge was to catalyze a national conversation about fiscal conditions and implications and trade-offs. So based on sort of what we just discussed, what kind of conversations do state officials need to be having now with their constituents about their fiscal situation? And how do they engage their constituents in the development of the trade-offs that are going to have to be made?
You know, that's such a great question, because to me, the conversation's pretty easy. It's about exactly what you said. It's about trade-offs. It's basic math. A certain amount comes in, and you can spend that, and that's it. Again, there are nuances to that, but that's pretty much where you are. So you have a zero-sum game, and then constituents, residents have to have a conversation with their elected officials about how they want the money that's coming in to be spent. The problem is, as you know, this is just so universally known, we have such distrust of government. And I think it's very difficult for elected officials and even appointed officials to have a conversation with their residents along those lines about trade-offs. Because again, it's simple math. And you have less money coming in. I mentioned you have as much as $200 billion in shortfalls this fiscal year. It could be worse. So if you want to spend the same amount on K-12 or more on K-12, something has to be cut, or you have to figure out how to bring more money in. And again, I think for most states, any tax increases are off the table. In some cases, they're talking about tax cuts. So you have less money coming in, but people want to spend money on certain activities and services. In many cases, you need to. And in some cases, there's no choice. Under the Medicaid program for low-income individuals, that healthcare expense is going up, and most of that is statutory, and it's very difficult to avoid those additional expenditures. So you already start with less money coming in, more money going to healthcare and other activities and services. And so the question becomes, the conversation has to be, this is how it works, and we can't spend money on everything. You can't have it all. There are going to be cuts, especially if there are no tax increases. So let's figure out how that works. Now, I have seen in past recessions, I know that Michigan governors of both parties, they had such a volatile economy with the ups and downs of the auto industry. I think they did a good job of going around. It's hard to do that during COVID, but they went around and they had a lot of town halls and explained this. And I think they were relatively effective. I know in Washington State, they had the newspapers do something called the budget game. And they encouraged constituents to go online, and it helped them understand, okay, I want to spend more in K-12. Well, again, it's basic math. So then you have to cut somewhere or raise taxes somewhere. So there are ways, I think, to engage constituents with the conversation that these are trade-offs. We make them every day. Sometimes they're hard choices. They're really painful. We make them every day in our household. And I know many households have seen income declines, and they are making those tough decisions. What do I cut? How can I get more money in if possible? And where do I spend the money?
So I was really glad to hear you offer a couple of examples of where this is done reasonably well. And hopefully, you know, the move to getting people connected online facilitates those kinds of conversations and it forces the adoption of some technology in a really interesting way. I want to circle back a little bit. We talked a little at the beginning about federal support to state and local governments, but talk a little bit more about sort of this in a stable environment, right? The intergovernmental aspects of fiscal health and how tax policy specifically fits into that.
Well, you know, it's really interesting. I think part of the problem that we're seeing now is we're getting away with the situation of really trying to figure out the ultimate result of what we want at both the federal level, the state level, and the local level. We want to solve problems. That's what the people want. Unfortunately, and I've seen it in the last few years worse than I've ever seen it in my career, we are hampered by the partisan polarization. And it's very unfortunate because we really should be having policy discussions as to how we should approach the tax system, how we should be doing taxation, and how we should be spending the money that's coming in from the taxes that are levied. And so that has been, to me, a real problem, to not be having a conversation on policy, which we might have very significant disagreements about, but we're getting into rhetoric and we're not having a rational conversation, and we're often seeing people have conversations. They're not even talking about the same thing. It's like two ships passing in the night. Now, that being said, I think there is some hope to think about ways in which you can focus on those results in solving problems. And let me make a couple of comments about taxation, because particularly at the state and local level, you really see an interesting dynamic going on. And that is that there's economic activity going on. And what should be happening is there should be an equitable taxation of hopefully fairly low rates of all the economic activity. And then the money coming in from the taxes is used for education and health, building roads and things like that. But unfortunately, what's happened to the tax systems over the last few decades is we're actually taxing a lot less of the economic activity. And that's creating not only volatility in revenues, but a real uneven distribution across the country. What you're seeing, for example, in California, they have a fair amount of taxes. They tax income, they tax sales, and their income tax is fairly progressive. The drawback to that is during a downturn like this, with people making less money, they're going to have much more wild swings. So in the good times, they're really doing well, in the bad times, they're really doing bad. That's less so in some of the other states that don't have that degree of levels of taxation. But the other thing that's going on is you're very dependent on certain sources. So if you're in a jurisdiction where you have property taxes, which tend to be local, and those go to K through 12, but you're either lowering them or the market's poor, whatever's going on in the economy, you're bringing in less tax revenue from the property tax, you have less money for K through 12 education. So it does get complex, but the bottom line is that the type of taxation that a particular state or locality has is having a real impact on their fiscal health at the moment. What would be perfect, and I don't see this happening given the polarized partisan environment, what would be really good is to have a discussion about that and figure out, is there a way to lower overall taxes and tax rates while you're still bringing in the revenue, but it's more equitable, it's more distributed across the economy, and then taxes aren't as high in some areas as they might otherwise be, and you're bringing in the revenue that you deem sufficient for the needs that your residents want. They want to spend money on certain services. They want money for K through 12, for roads, and so forth.
You mentioned equity a couple of times there. Some localities have moved from a tax structure to a fee structure, right? Where, you know, if you, they don't put tax money towards the sports clubs, for example, you pay to use them. How does that impact both the stability of the revenue base and the equity of the revenue base?
Well, you know, that's a good question. And it's very interesting because one thing that seems to have occurred over the last few years is that you're seeing a massive increase in the dependence on fees for the different services. A lot of state parks, for example, if you visited them when I was a kid, you wouldn't have paid a fee. Now they tend to be fee-based. You pay a fee to go camp at the state park. What's interesting about that is it tends to be controversial, but not necessarily based on ideology. Some of both parties and ideologies tend to be supportive of fees and others do not. But it does create a bit of volatility because if you are fee-based, you are seeing less fees come in for, say, the state park or the local park or whatever the case may be, when there's a decreased use. So, to me, it's going to be interesting to see going forward how the different constituents feel about really a much more dependence on people paying fees for the services they use rather than a more general tax distribution across the board for all the different services.
Well, certainly as people see their income constrained, they're less likely to consume those services, right, for which they need to pay a fee, which of course then gets you back into that negative spiral, the snowball analogy. Whichever.
Absolutely, yeah.
So it gets to be really challenging. So what, when states are trying to figure their way through this, what's the role of organizations like the National Governors Association or the National Association of State Budget Officers in providing them resources and guidance? How do those organizations help?
The national organizations, particularly those that are bipartisan and they're not divided by party, can be really helpful by providing information and sharing information. For example, it's really helpful for an Arkansas to know what Minnesota is doing and what a Minnesota needs to know what Arkansas is doing. They may not copy it. They may not find that it works for them, but just knowing about it really helps, because I find, and I can say this as someone who worked in a state capital for a long time in Richmond, Virginia, it's real easy to get caught up in your own state policies and you're busy and you don't have time to find out what's going on in other states. So to the extent you know what's going on in other states and there's information sharing, that can be really, really beneficial, because then you know that another state levied a certain type of tax, didn't work so well, so you can learn from that. Or you may find a particular state found that providing a privatization of their state car fleet actually save them money, and you may want to copy that. I'm also an advocate of looking internationally. We tend in the U.S. not to do that as much, but there are provinces in Canada that are finding all kinds of ways to spend less but have better outcomes. I love this example of the province of Ontario, where they really focused on making sure that ambulance drivers noted what the household was like when they picked up a patient. And they were finding elderly going to the hospital twice a month. But once the ambulance drivers said, well, you know what, that home is really unsafe and there's clutter and the resident hoards. And so what happens is the social services folks come in or the mental health folks come in and you dramatically decrease the amount of times that individual has to call an ambulance and go to the hospital. So you get a better health outcome for less money, because obviously going to the emergency room all the time is expensive. And just knowing that and learning from each other, I think is a real positive thing. And so to the extent that national organizations can do that and look past whether or not it's run by a Republican or a Democrat or in Canada, you know, a liberal or a conservative, and just say, hey, this is a good policy and you ought to look at it.
So let's wrap up on that question. We could keep going on this.
I know.
We're going to run out of time. That example that you just gave really requires common data sharing, breaking down of silos, grant programs that can be braided together to focus on outcomes and not compliance. If you were going to give one piece of advice to your state budget officers about how to address this sort of financial management for the future. Let's say you get through COVID, advice for the future. What would be your nugget?
Well, I think what's really important, and it's hard to do, and being a former budget officer, director in Virginia, I really get this, because you're so spread thin and busy. But what really needs to happen is there needs to be a stepping back, like you said, when the crisis is over, and strategize and prioritize. And frankly, the elected officials have to be a big part of that. The governors and the state legislators have to step back and say, you know what, whether it's a formal commission or whatever the case may be, here are the priorities of the states and of the state and how we want to lay out spending the money over time. Another thing that needs to be done, and this is so critical, is to look more than a year or two out. It's so hard to do that in our political environment. But we really need to, even if they're not looking at it, give elected officials 5 years of future projected data and say, if we don't do something about our increasing prison population, our costs in corrections are going to skyrocket. If we don't put a little bit of money away for pensions over the next 5 years, we're going to be in a huge hole in the ability to pay future pensions. Whatever the case may be, just make sure that elected officials and certainly the people are aware of the projected future so that they can act now to deal with the future problems. Because I see that so much. We tend to be so focused on the short term. It's definitely understandable during a crisis like this, but we have to start to think ahead. And I will say one really fantastic thing that's happened in the last few years, is technology has improved so much that we have access to data that is very inexpensive. And we can really use that data to make projections, to look at future costs, play around with different scenarios. Government is always slow to utilize improvements in technology. Let's stop that. Let's embrace it. It's there. There aren't a lot of resources that are necessary to expend. And let's use that to make better fiscal decisions for the future. And frankly, even though things look really dire from a financial standpoint for government right now, that type of approach can really, really get us in a better place in a very short time, in a few years.
Well, Scott, thanks for sharing your perspective with us and your nuggets there at the end. We're going to keep our fingers crossed for a quick vaccine and a treatment and a speedy recovery. And in the meantime, hope that our state budget officers are well prepared to weather the storm.
Yeah, no, it's certainly been difficult, I think, for a lot of state officials right now to get through this. Not only do they work remotely and all of their employees are working remotely, but they have a crisis to manage through. And that has to be difficult for anyone.
Well, Scott, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thanks.
Take care.
I enjoyed it.
For our listeners, check back every Monday for a new podcast from the Academy. We'll be talking to Academy fellows each week about the challenges facing public administrators at every level of government as we try to make government work and work for all. Thanks for listening.